Today is March the 2nd, 1973, a Friday. The following interview is with Alan Kaupinen, K-A-U-P-I-N-E-N, a staff assistant in the personnel office. The interview will be conducted by Jack Nesbitt and Terry Good. The interview will take place in room 143 of the old executive office building.
I'll hold the calls out except those goofy I.O. calls.
Okay, to start with, and simply for the record, if you could give us the date that you joined the White House staff initially, perhaps let's go even beyond that. Did you work during the transition period or the 68 campaign?
Just no.
Okay. So when did you come on board initially?
I started here in June of 1969. And as I recall, the date was June 1st that I officially came on the rolls.
And you were on the White House staff then up until what time before you went across the street?
I was on the White House staff from June of 69 until November of 1971. That would be November 1st. Then I left on November 1st and I returned again on November 8th of 1972, one day after the election.
And your last day on the White House staff for the second tour will be March?
Probably will be,
Your last day then here would be sometime this month, is that right? I think you're supposed to report over GSA around the 15th, is that correct, Al? Or?
Yes, well actually I will start splitting some time come Monday, and I've gone through a series of a couple hours a day briefings for the last 2 weeks.
Again, that approximate date is quite satisfactory for our purposes now. For the first period as well as the second period, was your title staff assistant?
Yes, it was always staff assistant.
Did you always work in the personnel?
Yes,
operation.
Always worked in personnel.
For the first period, who was your secretary?
My first secretary was Nancy Warren. It's N-A-N-C-I, Warren.
And during the second session?
Well, my first secretary and I came back here was Barbara Fierce. And she had a baby in January, so the girl that works for me now is Betsy Calloway. Betsy happens to be the daughter of the national committee man from Georgia, Bo Calloway.
The man that got the most votes.
And lost.
Dramatic.
Yeah, right. That's him.
In terms of the documentation and the files in the personnel shop, let's say a researcher coming along 15, 20 years from now, would he be able to trace your path through the records and get a fair idea of what your responsibilities were, what you did?
No, I think from defining what my job was, that the records that could be found would only partially tell the story.
That answer is the one we normally get, so we're not surprised by it.
Mm-hmm.
But it gives us some idea of what to expect when we do get into the files.
Which is really the underpinning of why we're trying to get an oral testimony on the contributions people rendered during their service to the president here. So the papers and the tape, I think, nicely complement each other for historical purposes.
And in the event we want to get back to you in 10 years, Al, would you have a mailing address, a permanent mailing address that you might give us?
Yes, most likely the best way to reach me would be through my parents, who currently live at 558 Coolman Avenue, that's C-O-O-L-M-A-N Avenue, Ravenna, R-A-V-E-N-N-A, Ohio. And they've lived there for, I guess, 15 years now, and I'm sure will live there the rest of their lives. Phone number is 216-AX-6-6197.
With that very basic information out of the way, if we can go back now to the personnel shop when you came on board in June of 69, could you describe it in terms of its organizational structure and who the significant people were, and then place yourself in that?
Mm-hmm. When I came in June of 69, Harry Fleming was the special assistant to to the president for personnel. And the senior people that worked for him were as follows. I initially was classified as the administrative officer of the personnel shop. In addition to that, Harry had two men who related to the departments and agencies as department agency liaison men. One of those was Larry Dunn. He handled the cabinet departments. And the second man was George Bell. He primarily handled the agencies. Shortly after I came, Larry Dunn left to become the Assistant Secretary of Interior for Administration. And as I recall it, Bill Castleman, who left this shop and later went over to Bill Timmons' shop, assumed handling the responsibilities for many of the departments. Now, in addition to that, we had what we called a clearance shop. The primary purpose of the clearance shop was to take all the people who were being appointed to the policy-making positions and clear them with the appropriate senators and congressmen on the Hill. And Castleman had overview of the clearance operation. And the men who worked in the clearance operation were actually on the telephones doing most of the telephone calling, were Peter Millspaugh, who later went to Harry Dent's staff, David Lissy, who later went to the State Department and is now Secretary Rogers, one of his key staff members. That's L-I-S-S-Y. There's a gentleman named Joe Brown, who currently is at the State Department as, I believe, Deputy Inspector General. He was in the clearance shop. And then there was a young lawyer named Gary Cunningham, who went to the military service, and I know not where he is. That was the clearance operation, which was one of the other main functions of the shop. By all the people I've named to you were the key senior people that worked for Fleming at that time.
I understand that at some point there was an operation called Special Projects.
Mm-hmm.
Was that in existence at the time you were on board?
Well, Special Projects, to trace the history of this, Special Projects was to handle the staffing of presidential boards and commissions and to set policy as to how we could make input into the departmental and agency boards and commissions. Now, the history on how that happened is it was initially conceived that the board and commission staffing would somehow be handled in conjunction with the RNC. But by the time I came here, it was not very organized, or it was not considered to be very organized, because there wasn't a rapid staffing of the presidential boards. And so then the idea was brought forth and later adapted that the boards and commissions would come under Harry Dent's operation. And again, they had some startup problems on it, as I recall it. And so then it was kind of moved over to Darrell Trent, who worked for Flanagan, and there were three young people that were hired to do this staffing. Well, about August, again, I don't think that there was a very strong feeling that it was moving like it should. So Special Projects was pulled in with Fleming's office having total responsibility for it, and Special Projects, I was made the manager of Special Projects in addition to my administrative duties. And in the Special Projects area, we had the people who worked there at that time were Maylees Block, who is now at the State Department, Kay Kelly, who I don't know where she is, there was a fellow named Gidwitz, and Jim Gidwitz, yes, I worked with his brother Ron in the Illinois campaign. That's why I had to hesitate for a second to make sure I gave you the right one, Jim Gidwitz. But Gidwitz and Kelly left very shortly after I assumed responsibilities for that, and I won't expand on why that happened. And we put some additional people in there. Terry Polson, who was a friend of Julie Eisenhower, Julie Eisenhower's, and Terry was a White House intern, and I used her in that and then kept her on for a year. And she did a very good job at it. And I think that, I believe that most people would tell you that we turned that thing around, that it became a well-organized, viable part of the personnel process here. And in essence, the way boards and commissions are staffed now are staffed like we set it up then.
As the administrative officer for this operation, what were your primary responsibilities?
Mm-hmm. Well, the primary responsibilities I had was is that at that time there was a tremendous volume on this office. It was absolutely incredible. And because of the volume, oh, the answering of correspondence and the status checks to the Hill and the general ways that the office functioned were not satisfactory in Fleming's estimation, and he specifically brought me in to look at that, to study it, and to make it work. And as I recall, we had mail when I first came here that was like 6 weeks behind, and status checks that were 6 and 7 weeks behind. And over a period of about 6 weeks, we caught the backlog. And not only did we catch the backlog, but then we had a turnaround time that within 48 hours, the Hill always received their status checks. And the mail, I would run tracers on it where from date of receipt to date of answering out of the correspondence section, we were answering most mail in 3 days. And so we basically turned around the administrative aspects of the office. And my other responsibilities were primarily as Harry's maybe chief assistant, in that when special problems came up or special things had to be done, he would give many of those things to me.
Was Harry Schott at this point one that in which you would have a regular staff meeting once a week, once a day, every morning at 9 o'clock or anything like that?
Yes. We had a staff meeting always, at least once a week. And as I remember, they were held at 8 o'clock on Tuesdays or something, but we had them on a regular basis. And then also, Harry would call many special staff meetings based on certain needs of the office. He'd pull in the key staff, and we'd develop a direction we wanted to take and go from there. But we did have a frequent staff meetings.
In handling personnel selections, I understand that you would have to be in contact with Bill Timmons' shop, Harry Dent's shop, I think later on Chuck Colson's shop at some point, as well as any others. At least I knew the Harry Fleming personnel shop was involved in all those. Did you yourself have frequent contact with any of these other shops, or were you pretty much an in-office operator?
Oh, no. I had very, very close working relationships, particularly with Harry Dent, and also at that time was Bryce Harlow. So we had close contact with Bryce Harlow, and later when Chuck came in, I had close contact with him, because one of the other things I later took on was the handling of the ethnics and also the handling of financial contributors, as to defining which of those people merited the greatest consideration for various presidential appointments, categorizing those and making sure where they merited it that they received presidential appointments. So I also handled the ethnics and was Harry's man for handling relationships with Mr. Stans on financial contributors.
So your contacts were not only within the personnel shop and within the White House, but even outside the White House.
Yeah, it was very broad. As a matter of fact, the way the departmental and agency liaison men were organized is each man had a responsibility for a certain number of departments or a certain number of agencies. But I actually had access to all of them directly, because all the referrals for people to go on part-time boards and commissions came out of administrative political, which I was in charge of. So therefore, I had access to all the departments and agencies. So I had access to all the White House staff, all the departments, agencies, and of course our inside staff, and then also all the state party organizations and things of that nature. So it really cut across all the lines.
Did you have any direct contact with Capitol Hill, or did you almost in all cases work through Bryce Harlow's shop for that?
No, the Capitol Hill, of course, would recommend directly to Harry. Letter comes in, here's an outstanding candidate that we'd like to be considered. And many times the senators or the congressman would call back personally, what happened to this letter that I sent on Joe Jones? And many times we responded or worked directly with various senators and various congressmen on their needs.
Were you, for the most part, operating out of the White House, or did you find that you did any traveling, either up to Capitol Hill itself, or the RNC, or departments and agencies, or even outside Washington?
Well, I did no traveling outside Washington because the job didn't necessitate that. However, I did travel to Capitol Hill, and I did travel many times to the Republican National Committee, and traveled all the time to various departments and agencies. You know, and I'd have a meeting with HEW, as often they would come here. Many times I would purposely go there to see them on their own home ground to see how they operate there. Because we, in essence, were analyzing how well they were doing this political personnel job. And as an old manager with Procter & Gamble, one of the things that you try to do is often to see the man in his own environment to see how he looks when he's operating on his own home ground.
So you might have been going to any of these departments and agencies and meeting with any of the people that had been a political appointee, is that right?
Sure.
Not only to check them out, but also to get information from them on slots or positions that were open and who might be the type of person they want to fill these with.
That's right.
There are many other questions we could ask on that first phase, but if we could just move now chronologically to the period of time when you were working on the campaign, if you could just briefly touch upon what your responsibilities were and where you were working there.
Because it's covered up to November 71.
Okay. Can I back up on one thing in that other period that I think is very important as to the imprint that Fleming's leadership left on personnel for the president? And that is that when the new administration came in, obviously, there was no manual that was handed to us and said, here, fellas, here's the way we want this done. So in essence, one of the things that we had to do was to conceptualize the best way to do this whole program. And in essence, it's become more sophisticated each year. I've seen it from its incubation period right through today. But I would say the conceptually as to what the purpose of the office is and how it operates has not changed significantly from that formulation period, which I think was, which I feel is a tribute to Harry's ability to see how to do this particular function for the president.
We try to avoid asking for opinions or appraisals.
Okay.
Now, that's one of the reasons why I didn't. We certainly thank you for what you
okay.
had to say.
That's good, because he's not a personnel man either, is he? He's a journalist and political animal or anything else?
Well, I would classify him as an extremely astute political person, but also, you know, he, as a baby, his father was Secretary of HEW, and he sat on President Eisenhower's lap as a tiny child, and he grew up right in government, so his ability to see and understand how to do all this was quite remarkable.
If you want to move on. Now, again, as Jack says, if there's something else that you feel is significant about that first period of time, by all means, volunteer it, because our questions are very much kind of shots in the dark. We hope will cover the horizon, but often they don't.
The only other things that I would think are significant about it is that in any way you analyze this type of an operation personnel, it's basically or almost a no-win game. In other words, for every applicant you have, for every job you have many hundreds of applicants. And for the person who finally ends up getting the job, regardless of how much finessing and work and everything it takes for this shop to do it, that individual always feels that he got the job because he was such a super qualified individual. And for the other 99 or 500 that didn't get that job, they never consider it their own lack of abilities or their own lack of political support. that caused them not to get the job. It's always the fault of the White House. So it is a, it is an interesting, it is an interesting vocation to be in that it's hard to come out and do it for a long time and have everybody think you do a good job at it. But I consider that primarily the nature of the beast. And I think that is a significant part of that, that I think as you do these things, you'll find that there will be people who will say, geez, they didn't do it fast enough or they didn't do enough of it. But a lot of that's germane to the whole business of personnel management.
Well, you were out to prune from the list of people with political sponsorship, those truly best suited for the jobs that had to be filled.
Precisely.
And so the political sponsorship got them into the ball game, but then the personnel shop really sat down and began to look nitty gritty at can they do it,
mm-hmm.
rather than take a risk and install somebody and have the whole thing go down the tubes. Do you think that Harry Fleming had the final say, or did the process really continue on up the line beyond Fleming's shop, maybe without modification, but at least for sign-off?
No. Well, it varied some. On certain positions, obviously, there were other parties that rightfully should have been in the decision-making process. And Peter Flanagan played a very strong role in the early days of the administration in the personnel aspects, particularly with ambassadors and chairman of the various regulatory committees and things of that nature. And I think that was certainly, she was good. It was an additional input. And certainly Mr. Haldeman and Mr. Ehrlichman and a number of other people were involved in the process. Bryce Harlow.
I seem to recall that somebody told me that there was a kind of a committee consensus approach in many instances where Harry would sit down with Harry Dent, Bryce Harlow, or perhaps several others whose names don't come to mind at this point, and go over many of these people who were being considered, and each of these other people would offer their opinions about the pros and cons on each one of these people. Did it in some instances work that way out?
Yes. On the full-time job, some of that was done, but it was less formalized. Eventually, on the boards and commissions, part-time appointments, we established what we call the White House Review Board. And the sitting members of the White House Review Board were Harry acted more or less as the chairman, and Harry Dent sat in on those, and Bill Timmons and or his representative, often he would send Castleman, and Chuck Colson, and or often he sent George Bell. I believe Murray Chotiner sat in on those for a while. It varied. Darrell Trent sat in on them for a while. I sat in on every one of them from the beginning. But we had the White House Review Board that helped in that procedure. So you did get a good input of many different ideas and many different constituencies before we actually made appointments.
And some of these people were probably speaking on behalf of the Cabinet Secretary, whose department had these slots to fill. Is that right? I would assume that, let's say just for the sake of it, the Secretary of Agriculture would offer his suggestions on the top 10 people that were under consideration for the Undersecretary's position or something of that sort.
Well, in the early days of the administration, of course, the cabinet officers, I believe, had a greater input on many of those positions because often they would actually have a candidate that would be agreeable, and their input was very strong. This thing has evolved in this restaffing that we've come back to, which I'm sure we'll get into, there's been a greater White House role in the final candidate. But we always did hold the final clearance on them. Should somebody want to appoint somebody as to a presidential appointment, they can't do it without this shop.
I might as well ask one more question. That is, the procedure which was followed early in the personnel selection process that received a great deal of publicity was the alleged use of the who's who. Would you have any comments to make about how important a role that actually played, and if it did play a role, was it rather successful? Did it do the job that you anticipated that it would do?
My assessment of the who's who is as follows. When that mailing was made, it received widespread publicity all over this country. There wasn't a newspaper in the United States that did not carry the fact that the mailing had been made to who's who. And I think it was conceived by the general public as there is a president who's looking for all the best talent to come to his administration. So I think that overall, across the country, it was a plus from the standpoint of what was conceived by the average citizen. I think for those people that are in Washington or more intimately familiar with this, that it got to be a little bit of it received some snide comment from many people. And it was a little bit of a monster. You know, all this came back, sifting it out and everything. I can't really say that I feel it had a strong impact in the number of people brought in. I don't think it did.
Well, I have no more to ask you about that first session. If you want to now touch briefly on the political year.
Okay. Well, I had had an interest in that point personally in working for the president's reelection. And as I recall, there were probably 15 or 20 people at the most that had been hired over at the Committee for Reelection. Jeb Magruder and Harry Fleming were the first two, and then Hugh Sloan and Rob Bolt and a few others. But there was virtually no one over there when I went over. And I went over to work for Harry Fleming in the establishment of the state chairman for each of the 50 states. And in a nutshell, what our job was is to take each state, analyze from all the various political factions what person would best serve as the president's chairman for that state. Could bring together these factions, understood enough about campaign management politics that he'd do a good job on it. And I think, as I recall, I traveled in the 37 states in that endeavor. And we made recommendations on a regular basis. And when the recommendation was accepted, and Mr. Mitchell made the final determination on that, we would then go visit with the potential chairman candidate, talk with him about what was expected this time, and then if he agreed to make those sacrifices, then we would name him chairman. We would handle the press aspects of timing the press announcement in a certain state so that it was most timely politically. And once the person had been publicly announced, then we did the initial orientations as to what the campaign was, how it would be conducted, how we expected their organization to be set up, how they should handle the new campaign financing law, and a myriad of other things. After most of the state chairmen were in line and announced, then Mr. Mitchell named five people as regional directors for the campaign. And those five people were Harry Fleming, Bob Mardian, Don Mosman, Clayton Yeider, and myself. And when we had high-level strategy sessions at that time, those five regional directors plus Fred LaRue, Fred Malik, and Jeb Magruder sat in on those. After Mr. Mitchell left the campaign and Clark McGregor became the campaign manager, he expanded the number of regional directors to 10 because of the heavy workload on the five. But I maintained the same seven states I had under Mr. Mitchell. I had all the New England states plus Illinois, and then I was a regional director for the rest of the campaign for those states. Do you want me to comment on how we set up the campaign in those states?
Yes, if you will. Again, we're very conscious of the fact we promised 45 minutes, so I don't want to go beyond that unless...
Well, to take as an example the state of Illinois, how basically I feel that campaign was managed by me is as follows. We did the budgeting on the state as to what the overall campaign budget should be. The campaign chairman, Tom Hauser, had been selected. We assisted then in finding an executive director, Bill Duvall, for for the campaign. He's head of public affairs for BorgWarner. We brought him in for 4 months to help manage the campaign for us. Out in the state of Illinois, we hired a 35-man paid field force, young, politically astute people. I divided the state into 35 territories. Each of those field people were responsible for usually one telephone bank and two or three storefronts. We had 35 telephone banks in the state and some 100 plus storefronts. And then we established for each telephone bank and for each storefront quotas for the telephone banks and how many calls they had to make, and for the storefronts on how many doors they had to knock on door-to-door canvassing. And I pretty much ran it like you'd run a sales organization. He who did not meet those quotas on a weekly basis, we went out and trained them to do the job better. And if they didn't do the job better, we replaced them with somebody else. But the campaign in Illinois was really became kind of a model for how the rest of the country was run. The first door-to-door canvassing kickoff that was sponsored by the Committee for Re-election was the Joliet, Illinois campaign kickoff door-to-door canvassing, which was on June the 24th, 1972. And the Illinois campaign, I think, was characterized by the fact that there was very close relationships with the other candidates, very good relationships with the party. There was no trouble between the Committee for Re-election and the regular Republican Party. It was a very successful campaign. We actually door-to-door canvassed over 1 million households and had very successful work with our telephone banks. And when the campaign was over, we had operated under budget. So that's what I did for 7 days a week for about 1 year of my life.
Were you doing a lot of traveling during this time out in all of these various states, New England as well as Illinois?
Yes, I would usually leave on Sunday or Monday and would be gone an average of about 4 or 5 days a week. And I would come back and do my office work on Saturdays and Sundays. And I was in my states because I strongly felt that to properly manage a campaign, you've got to get out there and really analyze and show them how it should be done. You can't be a backseat driver and sit by your phone in Washington and complain about what they're not doing correctly. So I did travel very extensively.
How about the records of your activities during the campaign? I seem to recall at least two large boxes, if not more, of material with your name on it from the Committee for the Re-election. Not having looked at it, had no idea what's in there. But again, as we asked you before, let's say a researcher 30 years from now, would he get some fairly decent feel for what you did, the approach you took, the organization that you built up, and the way you ran the whole thing?
Well, I think in the campaign, we had a group stay over there and write summaries for this particular purpose. And I have read those summaries of the political operation. I think they pretty well reflect what we did. Of course, what you can never reduce to paper is the fact that of how that was all put together and how we just grabbed those pieces and eventually developed that door-to-door canvassing program. That's probably not as well reflected, but I think that the records on the campaign are probably pretty good.
In terms of the states that you were the director of, could you rank them in terms of the amount of time that you spent either in the state or just attending to affairs relating to that state?
Mm-hmm. Well, since the electoral votes of Illinois were 26, that's where I spent most of my time. I did have work for me a gentleman named Louis Laun, L-A-U-N, who is now the Associate Administrator for Operations of the Small Business Administration. At the time he worked for me, he was the Chairman of the Board of Salinese Corporation as a field man for New England. So we'd usually see each other once a week, and I had him handle as much as I could the New England states after a certain point, I think mainly after about September 1st. But I also visited those states for their canvas kickoff meetings and for their get-out-the-vote meetings. But I spent more time where the eggs were, which was Illinois. The second most amount of time I spent was in Connecticut, because that was my next largest state. And I spent the least amount of time in Massachusetts. And I also had the smallest budget for Massachusetts per electoral vote of any state in the Union. And I think that was a very wise decision that was made early on. You have to spend your money where the electoral votes are.
Was there a fair amount of coordination between you and the other four regional directors, or did each one of you kind of go off your separate way and act independently of the others?
Well, you have the difficulty when you first start out of getting everybody on the same railroad track. But eventually it came around. When we had the 10 regional directors, we had regular meetings, and I think everybody was aiming for the same goal then. And since we had some very measurable quotas that we had in all the states and a very sophisticated reporting system through an 800 number, you could pretty much separate the men from the boys as to how it was getting done. And we were all pretty much on the same track, that door-to-door canvassing and getting the telephone banks to do their work was the most important thing a regional director had to do. And I think it pretty much came together. But in the early stages, there was great difference on opinion as to which direction we should actually take. And I think the Illinois experience put everybody on the same track, that people talk all the time about grassroots politics. Every time a politician gives a speech, he tells you about the grassroots politics. But most of it's all talk. Nobody really ever does much of it. But I think in this campaign, the thing that differentiated it from, in a lot of ways, from any other campaign, is the real grassroots door-to-door canvassing and proper handling of telephone banks was really done. And it's kind of interesting. That's never the thing that gets in the newspapers. If you read in the papers the account of the campaign, you read about voter blocks and the November group and things like that, which were an important part of the campaign, and very little about the door-to-door aspects of that campaign. And that, by far, was the thing that was done so much better than any other campaign's done it. But it doesn't really come through very strongly in anything you read. It's not the exciting things you can write about in books, I guess.
Jack, do you have any questions on this?
No, make the transition into the November 72 visit back here, perhaps by asking how far in advance was the second term planning really started?
Well, that was pretty much under Fred Malik's purview, and they had started doing some of this. Dan Kingsley was over here, as you know, and they had started to do some of the planning and recruitment of candidates and things, I'm sure, as early as early summer. But Fred asked me to come back over here, I guess, sometime after Labor Day, and because I had been here before and knew what we had to do. So some of the work had been done, but a lot less than I think we should have had done. And I think Fred would very much endorse that statement.
Again, was the organizational structure of the personnel shop for the most part similar to the one that you'd worked in prior to the time you left for the campaign?
Yes, it was similar, except that we have three liaison men to the departments and agencies now. And as I recall, there were only two when I left. So we beefed that up. And then the particular responsibility I've had here post-election has been a special position, in that I have not worked as a liaison man this time. I've been primarily responsible for the effective placement of those people from the campaign. That would be the 1701 staff and the state campaigns, plus those people from the inaugural, so that those that wanted to be considered for government had that opportunity and had a chance to come in the administration. And I've also handled the political aspects of this shop since November. So I have had a different role this time than I had the last time.
Are you the only one that is responsible for this placement of these people from these 1701, the inaugural and the state campaign things?
No. Actually, my role is one of having a central point that is responsible for it, that categorizes the priority on the people, and then I send it to the liaison men for placement. And then I have a series of reports and things that I have to track how well we're getting this placement done.
Do you have anybody helping you in this job, Al, other than Betsy Calloway?
Yes, Fred Karam, who will be staying here after I leave, is picking up a lot of what I've done. In addition to that, we had girls working as staff assistants on it, and those girls were Jane Pierpoint Lynch, who had worked in the 68 campaign, then she'd been a scheduler for the vice president, the vice president's office, then she was John Whitaker's assistant here in the White House, then she had a baby, then she came back and worked with Barbara Franklin in recruiting, then she was my assistant in the campaign over there, and then I brought her back here. So she had a real broad gauge of knowing all the people and how to do it. Barbara Fierce did a lot of that work, and Helen Quincy, who worked in the campaign, also did a lot of that work. And from time to time, we use other special people. But we were pretty much receive, filter, categorize, and follow to see the job gets done.
Who are the other principal people in the personnel shop during the second phase?
Well, during the second phase, of course, Fred Malik was the top man until he went to OMB. And the primary people that worked with him were Jerry Jones, Stan Anderson, who was a liaison man, Rob Davison, who was a liaison man, Frank Herringer, who was a liaison man till he left. Then Lewis Dale had been brought back in from the campaign to assist Frank Herringer, and then he took Frank's place. And then each of those fellows has a staff. And then also Fred had a outreach recruiting staff, which included Penn James, Bill Marimoto, Barbara Franklin, and Guy Simpler, Bill Zook, Al Parmenter, several other people. So we really had a political, a liaison, and a recruiting capacity.
And your contacts with the people on this, in this personnel shop, are probably as frequent as they were in the previous one. Mm-hmm. Any sort of routine staff meetings again on occasion?
Yeah, Fred generally would get us together every week and a half or so. Jerry, we've had averaged one or better staff meetings per week since he's taken over Fred's job.
And documentation of your activities during this phase, would they be good enough for a researcher to follow you?
Well, the only way they'd be good enough for somebody to do that is if they were today to take my list of who came from the campaign and who came from the inaugural and how they were prioritized and took them now, because I think most of these things, after we've utilized them and gotten everybody placed, we'll probably throw them away.
So you do that.
No, I'm not going to be here, but you know, there. Yeah. If the files continue to pile up, but we've got it all very well categorized now. Yeah, I know all the placement progress and everybody.
Jack, you got any questions about this?
No, I don't think so.
Again, as I hope you can see, we're not trying to go into any detail at this point, Al, because obviously time doesn't permit and we don't have enough knowledge. Hopefully after we've gone through some of the files and we become more familiar with these, then we can come back and carry on what might be more of a two-sided conversation where we might have a great deal more knowledge than we do now, certainly not as much as you would have, but it would make for a more informative and productive session. But I think you've hit the highlights. You've given us some guidelines. And I think our eyes are a lot wider open now than they were certainly when we came in here. What we'll try and do is do a resume of this at this point, send it to you, let you modify it or do whatever you wish with it in terms of giving us a feel that of what you did, avoiding anything that's sensitive or controversial at this point, because the resume would be something we would keep in the file for the researcher to look at immediately when the library opens.
When will that be?
You're going to have a big hand in helping that happen, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
Between you and Leonard Firestone and Bob Haldeman, why, we don't know. The site selection question is starting to move along a little bit. And Firestone will be in town Tuesday night, I guess, for a stag dinner next door, and then up at the archives on Wednesday. We got some ideas for a brochure that might be used in fundraising. As soon as he can get a go-ahead on fundraising, I think they'd begin. We're at work on the facility plan itself, not what the architect would do, but things that the architect ought to be told about that makes us different than a county and public library that he might build somewhere else. What makes an archival depository or presidential library different? What do you have to remember to include? Security vault or temperature control? How people use this? It isn't a book lending library, it's a place where materials never leave. A researcher comes in to use the papers or the films or something like that. Public people, the average American comes in to look at objects in the museum. So I think things are starting to move along. And I imagine that along with all the other construction work and things that GSA does, that as we get near to January 77, the people in and around the Oval Office will begin to think about the life hereafter of the administration, and that's what the library is.
And we feel we're kind of like the, what was an early analogy I used, I guess?
Used several.
Well, we're like St. Peter in a sense. We're keeping book on this administration so that in the life hereafter it'll all be there, we hope, in a good fashion.
Is the utilization of the presidential libraries like Johnson's Library, are they heavily utilized by historians?
As they age, it's like whiskey, I think. The Roosevelt Library is the oldest and most mature, and it is, has really been used quite a bit. Now, attendance figures in the research portion are so tiny compared to attendance figures for a museum portion.
I'm thinking of the research part.
But the Roosevelt Library has had a lot of fine researchers, as well as a master's student or even a college student writing a paper. But a lot of the fine historical writers, like Schlesinger and others, have turned out a lot of good material based on the contents of that library. Joe Lash's book that won the Pulitzer Prize last year, Franklin and Eleanor, was based on things that the family finally said, what the heck, let them have at it. So here we're, if you remember reading that book or hearing about it, Eleanor's own notes on her husband's liaisons during the war with this Lucy Rutherford Mercer. But by then, the sons and daughter felt, time's passed, we might as well even open that stuff up.
Sure.
But aside from that, just the good, rich material, I think has been research fodder for an awful lot of good stuff. It's about the only place where all this presidential material filters down. We like to think that because of this first-time advance project, that ours is maybe going to be a little more comprehensive and less of a rush at the tail end. Working with the people now in Central Files and throughout the complex, I've learned a lot from the six libraries by asking these people, play Monday morning quarterback, tell me what you'd have done if you could have been there where I am now.
Yeah.
These guys have a lot of ideas. We've tried to use them, and this is one of the inputs.
Well, the solicitation effort to get the personal papers of a lot of the political appointees is another one of the things we've undertaken.
Yeah, we went after about 250 key people on the appointee list, or as Haldeman set it up anyhow, the assistant secretary level above.
On the campaign, you know, the one part I mentioned about the door-to-door canvassing aspects and how good that really was. Have you delved into those papers enough where you can pick that out, or is it just too early to do that?
All we bought, the moving company estimated 2,500 cubic feet of material, so.
We simply moved it over in the archives, Alan. I don't think we anticipate doing much with it until we get some of these other things out of the way for any number of reasons.
Our priorities are governed by the perishable nature of something.
Mm-hmm.
And that falls into the area of keeping the president scheduled or taping interviews with people who are leaving us. But anything that is left behind of a physical nature, if we have it, we have it. And we'll try to work on it a little later, with an exception maybe in the case of Ollie Atkins' photos. Ollie's like any good photographer. They take the picture. They never worry about describing it to anybody else. So if the Fred Malik staff has a group photo, all Atkins has to do is count 11 people around the table or something, and he'll send Malik 11 huge prints of it and let Malik worry about who the people are in order to get delivery accomplished. Well, presidential libraries have a lot of good photos that they can't do anything with. They recognize Harry Truman, obviously, but they're not sure even
who the other 10 guys,
who the other people are, where it was taken, when it was taken, or anything else. So we've had two of our gals also working on the Ollie Atkins stuff for our own.
How many people do you have working for you? I know the archivist told me that
the budget says 7, and we honestly have I was at the stop next. Alex has given us a secretary. We have no secretary people in the archives. She comes from VA, and that leaves 9 of us on the archives payroll. So the budget says 7, and Robertson tells the Congress 7, and we have 2 other ones. And it's not a dishonest thing. One guy is always involved in audiovisual preservation work, and that's paid for out of another fund. And we have a trainee on loan that we hope to pick up permanent next fall. So it's just, they think punch the button. I think we're done.